A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking us to trace the history of anti-Semitism through three distinct traditions: the Christian world, the Islamic world, and its modern incarnation as anti-Zionism on the progressive left. The core question is whether these are manifestations of one continuous hatred, or fundamentally different phenomena with different roots, mechanisms, and consequences. I think the honest answer is the second one, and the distinctions matter more than most people realize.
They matter enormously, because if you treat anti-Semitism as a single, unchanging thing, you miss what makes each form dangerous in its own way. You also miss how to fight it. The Christian version gave us the Holocaust. The Islamic version gave us the Dhimmi system and, eventually, the near-total expulsion of Jews from Arab lands. And the modern anti-Zionist version is still evolving. We're watching it mutate in real time, often among people who genuinely believe they're opposing racism.
The three flavors of "we don't like Jews," each with its own recipe.
And the ingredients matter. Christian anti-Judaism was fundamentally theological. It was about Christ killing and supersessionism. The church taught that Jews were rejected by God, scattered as living proof of divine punishment. Islamic anti-Semitism was primarily legal and political. Jews were people of the book, which meant they had a recognized status, but it was a subordinate one. And modern anti-Zionism is ideological. It frames itself through anti-colonialism and post-nationalist politics, which is why you get self-identified progressives using tropes that would have made a medieval inquisitor nod along.
The "we're not racist, we're just anti-Zionist" Venn diagram and the surprisingly large overlap.
The overlap is where the most interesting and uncomfortable questions live. Let me frame this properly. Christian anti-Semitism runs from roughly the 2nd century, Melito of Sardis formalizing the deicide charge around 170 CE, all the way through the Nuremberg Laws of 1935. That's 17 centuries of theological hatred that eventually mutated into racial pseudoscience. The Islamic tradition runs from the Pact of Umar around 717 CE through the mid-20th century, with a major inflection point when European anti-Semitic texts got translated into Arabic in the 1920s. And anti-Zionist anti-Semitism really crystallizes in the 1970s with the Soviet "Zionism is racism" campaign, then gets picked up by the post-colonial left.
Three parallel tracks, different engines. Let's start with the Christian one, because it's the oldest and, by body count, the most lethal. What made it so uniquely deadly?
That's the key. In the Gospel of John, written probably around 90 to 100 CE, you already see the Jews framed as a hostile collective. Not individual Jewish leaders, not a specific faction, but the Jews as a group opposing Jesus. That rhetorical move was enormously consequential. By the time Melito of Sardis writes his Paschal homily in the late 2nd century, he's explicitly accusing Jews of deicide, killing God. And once you've established that a people kill God, there's no limit to what you could justify doing to them.
"They killed God" is a pretty comprehensive permission slip.
And it gets codified into law. The Theodosian Code of 438 CE and the Justinian Code a century later include specific provisions restricting Jews, where they can build synagogues, whether they can hold public office, whether they can testify against Christians in court. The Council of Basel in 1434 went so far as to ban Jews from obtaining academic degrees. This is structural exclusion built on a theological foundation.
The logic is, you rejected Christ, therefore God rejected you, therefore we're justified in treating you as permanently cursed. And if you ever seem to be doing too well, that's a problem, because it contradicts the theology of divine punishment.
And that's why you get these explosion points. The First Crusade in 1096, crusaders marching through the Rhineland massacred Jewish communities in Speyer, Worms, and Mainz before they even reached the Holy Land. The logic was, why travel thousands of miles to fight infidels when there are infidels right here? Thousands were killed or forced to convert. Then you get the first blood libel in Norwich in 1144. Jews accused of murdering a Christian boy named William for ritual purposes. That became a recurring template.
The blood libel is such a specific and bizarre accusation. It's not just, Jews are bad. It's Jews need Christian blood for their rituals. Where does that even come from?
Partly from a misunderstanding of Jewish dietary laws, the prohibition on consuming blood got twisted into its opposite. Partly from the broader medieval imagination, which was extraordinarily credulous about ritual murder accusations generally. But the blood libel served a function. It made Jews not just theological enemies, but literally demonic. If they're murdering Christian children for religious rituals, they're not just wrong about God, they're monsters. And that justifies whatever the mob wants to do.
This runs right through the Spanish Inquisition.
1478 to 1834. The Inquisition was specifically targeting conversos, Jews who had converted to Christianity, often under duress, and were suspected of secretly practicing Judaism. The logic here is important. Even conversion doesn't solve the problem. Jewishness becomes something in the blood, which is a direct precursor to racial anti-Semitism. The Spanish expelled their entire Jewish population in 1492. Portugal followed in 1497.
The Inquisition is where theological anti-Judaism starts bleeding into something that looks a lot like racial anti-Semitism, avant la lettre.
And then Martin Luther completes the transition in a sense. In 1543, he publishes On the Jews and Their Lies, which is shocking to read. He calls for burning synagogues, destroying Jewish homes, confiscating their prayer books, forbidding rabbis to teach, and, if that doesn't work, expelling them entirely. This from the founder of the Reformation. The Nazis later quoted Luther extensively in their propaganda. Julius Streicher, the publisher of Der Stürmer, cited Luther at Nuremberg as his defense.
The Luther to Hitler pipeline is not just a rhetorical flourish. There's a documented intellectual genealogy there.
There really is. But here's the critical distinction. Luther's anti-Semitism was still theological. He hated Jews for rejecting Christ. The 19th century racial anti-Semites, people like Wilhelm Marr, who coined the term anti-Semitism in 1879, or Houston Stuart Chamberlain, or Arthur de Gobineau, they didn't care about theology, they cared about blood. Jewishness became a racial category, immutable, something no conversion could fix. And that's the move that makes genocide possible.
Because if it's theological, conversion is always theoretically an option. If it's racial, there's no exit.
The Dreyfus Affair in France, 1894 to 1906, shows how this operated in a modern, secular republic. Alfred Dreyfus was a fully assimilated Jewish officer in the French army, falsely convicted of espionage. The mobs outside the courtroom weren't chanting about Christ killers. They were chanting death to the Jews. This is secular, racial anti-Semitism operating in the heart of the Enlightenment. Theodor Herzl was a journalist covering the Dreyfus trial, and it's what convinced him that assimilation couldn't work, that Jews needed their own state.
Then the Nuremberg Laws in 1935 codify this racial framework into law. By 1933, about 525,000 Jews lived in Germany, 0.75% of the population. By 1945, 6 million European Jews had been murdered.
And that required something new. Christian anti-Semitism created the cultural conditions, centuries of teaching that Jews were cursed, dangerous, deicidal. But the Holocaust required the specific combination of racial ideology, industrial bureaucracy, and total war. It wasn't inevitable. But the theological groundwork had been laid for 17 centuries.
That's the Christian tradition. A hatred rooted in theology that eventually mutated into racial pseudoscience and industrial murder. What about the Islamic world, where Jews were also second-class citizens, but for entirely different reasons?
This is where the comparison gets really instructive. The Pact of Umar, traditionally dated to around 717 CE, established the legal framework for dhimmis, protected peoples, specifically Jews and Christians. And the word protected is doing a lot of work here. Yes, they weren't slaughtered en masse as a matter of policy, but they were legally subordinate. They had to pay the jizya, a special tax. They couldn't build new places of worship. They couldn't bear arms. They had to wear distinctive clothing. Their testimony in court was worth less than a Muslim's. They couldn't ride horses, donkeys only, and sometimes not even those.
It's institutionalized second-class status, but it's not exterminationist. The logic isn't kill the Jews, it's keep the Jews in their place.
And the theological basis is completely different. In Islam, Jews are people of the book. They received an authentic, if incomplete, and later corrupted, revelation. They're not Christ killers because Islam doesn't have a deicide narrative. The Quran criticizes Jews in various passages, but it also acknowledges them as recipients of divine scripture. So the demonization that was central to Christian anti-Judaism is largely absent from classical Islamic sources.
Which is why you don't get blood libels in the Islamic world until much later, and they're imported from Europe.
The first blood libel in the Islamic world is the Damascus Affair of 1840, and it was instigated by a French monk. European Christians brought that particular poison, but that doesn't mean the Islamic world was a golden age of tolerance. That's a myth that needs to be addressed directly.
The golden age framing. I've heard this my whole life. Medieval Spain under Muslim rule. Jews flourishing as scholars and advisors. What's the reality?
The reality is that there were periods of relative tolerance and periods of intense persecution, often depending on who was in power and whether they needed Jewish expertise. Yes, there were Jewish viziers and physicians and scholars. Maimonides served as court physician to Saladin, but Maimonides' own family had to flee the Almohad persecutions in Cordoba. The Almohads gave Jews and Christians the choice of conversion, exile, or death. His family pretended to convert and eventually fled. That was 1148.
Even the Golden Age had pogroms.
The 1066 Granada Massacre is the most famous. Joseph ibn Nagrella, the Jewish vizier, was crucified by a Muslim mob, and about 1,500 Jewish families were killed. That's a pogrom. The Safed pogrom of 1834, another one. Periodic violence was always a possibility. The Dhimmi system kept Jews safe, ish most of the time, but the safety was conditional on accepting subordination. And when political dynamics shifted, that conditional safety could evaporate overnight.
The key distinction seems to be that Islamic anti-Semitism was structurally discriminatory, but not theologically exterminationist, while Christian anti-Semitism was theologically exterminationist, but not always structurally implemented, until it was.
Then the 20th century changes everything. Two things happen. First, European anti-Semitic texts get translated into Arabic. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion appears in Arabic translation in the 1920s and becomes enormously influential. The Muslim Brotherhood's founding charter in 1947 explicitly cites the protocols. Second, the establishment of Israel in 1948 transforms the political landscape.
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is a Tsarist forgery from around 1903. It purports to be the minutes of a secret meeting of Jewish leaders plotting world domination. It's been thoroughly debunked. The London Times exposed it as a fabrication in 1921, and yet it's still circulating in the Arab world.
The Hamas Charter of 1988 cites it explicitly. The revised charter of 2017 dropped the explicit citation but retained the conspiratorial framework. And this is the fusion that makes modern Islamic anti-Semitism so potent. You take traditional Dhimmi-era prejudice, add European racial anti-Semitism and conspiracy theory, and then attach the whole thing to the political conflict over Israel.
The Farhud in Baghdad, 1941. That seems like a pivotal moment.
It really is. June 1st and 2nd, 1941. A pro-Nazi coup in Iraq had just been overthrown by the British, and in the power vacuum, a mob attacked the Jewish community of Baghdad. 180 Jews killed, 1,000 injured, hundreds of homes and businesses destroyed. This is the largest pogrom in the modern Middle East, and it's a direct precursor to the mass exodus that followed 1948.
The numbers tell the story. In 1948, about 850,000 Jews lived in Arab countries. By 2020, fewer than 10,000 remain.
Fewer than 10,000? That's a demographic collapse of over 98%. Most of them left between 1948 and the early 1960s, driven out by persecution, legal discrimination, and violence. Morocco had about 265,000 Jews in 1948. Today there are maybe 2,000. Iraq had about 135,000. Today there are three Jews in Iraq.
That's not a community, that's a museum exhibit.
The point is, this didn't happen because of Israel. It happened because Arab governments and populations turned on their Jewish citizens. Israel was the destination, not the cause. The cause was the fusion of traditional Dhimmi prejudice with imported European anti-Semitism, supercharged by the political conflict.
The Islamic tradition gives us structural discrimination, punctuated by periodic violence, then a 20th century fusion with European racial anti-Semitism that produces mass expulsion. Different mechanism than the Christian tradition. Less theological demonization, more legal subordination, but a similar endpoint in terms of Jewish presence being essentially erased from the region.
And that brings us to the third tradition, modern anti-Zionist anti-Semitism. This is the one that's most controversial right now, and the one where the boundaries are most contested.
Because the people who hold these views often believe they're on the side of justice. They're not burning synagogues or chanting death to the Jews. They're chanting from the river to the sea, and calling Israel a settler colonial state. They'd be horrified if you called them anti-Semitic.
Some of them aren't anti-Semitic. That's what makes this difficult. Legitimate criticism of Israeli policy exists. Israel is a nation-state with a government and an army. It does things that can and should be criticized, like any other nation-state. The question is where criticism crosses a line, and what mechanisms are at work when it does.
Let's trace the origins. Modern anti-Zionism doesn't emerge from theology. It emerges from politics, specifically Soviet politics.
The Soviet Union's anti-Zionist campaign is one of the most underappreciated factors in modern anti-Semitism. After the Six-Day War in 1967, the Soviets launched a massive propaganda effort equating Zionism with racism, imperialism, and Nazism. This culminated in UN Resolution 3379 in 1975, which formally declared that Zionism is a form of racism. It passed with 72 votes in favor, 35 against, and 32 abstentions.
The UN officially declared that Jewish self-determination is racism. Let that sit for a moment.
It took until 1991, Resolution 4686, to revoke it. 16 years of a UN-sanctioned equation of Zionism with racism. The Soviet campaign was cynical. They were trying to peel Arab states away from American influence. But the ideological framework they created outlasted the Soviet Union itself.
Because it got picked up by the post-colonial left. The framework maps perfectly onto the oppressor-oppressed binary that dominates progressive politics. Israel is the white settler colonial oppressor. Palestinians are the indigenous oppressed. Everything else flows from that framing.
Once you accept that framing, a lot of things follow logically that look a lot like anti-Semitism. The Nazi analogy, comparing Israelis to Nazis, is everywhere now. You see it at protests, on social media, in student newspapers. But think about what that analogy does. It takes the people who were the primary victims of the Nazis and casts them as the new Nazis. That's not just a political critique, it's an inversion of history that serves to delegitimize Jewish claims to victimhood.
It's also factually deranged. Whatever you think of Israeli policy, the systematic industrial murder of 6 million people is not the same thing as a military occupation, however brutal.
And then there's the dual loyalty. Accusation. The idea that Jews cannot be loyal to both Israel and their home country. This is a classical anti-Semitic trope that goes back centuries. The Dreyfus Affair was built on it. And now it's reappeared in progressive discourse, often in the form of demands that Jewish organizations or individuals disavow Israel before being accepted in progressive spaces.
The litmus test. You can join our coalition, but first you have to renounce Zionism, which is functionally a demand that Jews renounce Jewish self-determination as a condition of political inclusion.
Then there's the disproportionate criticism pattern. The UN Human Rights Council has condemned Israel more than all other countries combined. In 2023, the UN General Assembly adopted 15 resolutions critical of Israel and 13 critical of all other countries in the world combined. When you're singling out the world's only Jewish state for condemnation, while ignoring far worse human rights violators, China's treatment of Uyghurs, Iran's execution of protesters, the Syrian civil war, you're not engaged in human rights advocacy. You're engaged in something else.
The IHRA definition tries to draw these lines. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition from 2016 says anti-Semitism includes denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination and applying double standards to Israel. But critics say this conflates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism and shuts down legitimate criticism.
That's the debate, and it's not going away. My view is that the Ichra definition is useful as a framework, not a cudgel. It identifies specific rhetorical patterns that cross a line, but it doesn't say all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. The examples it gives are things like using the symbols and images of classical anti-Semitism to characterize Israel, drawing comparisons between Israeli policy and Nazi policy, holding Israel to standards not expected of any other democratic nation. Those are specific, identifiable patterns.
Let's get concrete. The 2024 Columbia University encampments. Jewish students reported being blocked from entering campus spaces, told to go back to Poland, physically intimidated. Is that anti-Zionism or anti-Semitism?
When you're telling Jews to go back to Poland, which, by the way, is where 3 million Polish Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, you're not critiquing Israeli settlement policy. You're engaging in anti-Semitic harassment. The From the River to the Sea chant is another example. Its origins are in the Palestine Liberation Organization's 1964 charter, which called for the elimination of Israel. When you chant, "Palestine will be free from the river to the sea," you're calling for the elimination of the state that sits between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. That's not a call for a two-state solution. That's a call for the destruction of Israel.
The people chanting it often don't know that. They think it's a generic liberation slogan.
Some don't know. But the effect is the same regardless of intent, and this is where the progressive paradox really bites. Self-identified progressives who would never tolerate a racist generalization about any other group will casually deploy anti-Semitic tropes because they've been reframed as anti-Zionism. Zionists control the media is just, Jews control the media with a find and replace. The Israel lobby controls Congress, echoes the protocols of the Elders of Zion. The form is identical, only the vocabulary has changed.
The ADL recorded 8,873 anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. in 2024. That's a 140% increase from 2023. And a significant portion was linked to anti-Israel protests on college campuses.
140% increase in a single year. That's not a trend, that's an explosion. And it's happening in the most educated, most progressive spaces in America. Elite college campuses. The places that are supposed to be most attuned to prejudice and discrimination.
Which raises the question, why are self-identified progressives embracing positions that echo historical anti-Semitism? What's the mechanism?
I think there are several things happening. First, the oppressor. Oppressed binary is a totalizing framework. If you've organized your entire moral worldview around it, then Israel, as the stronger military power, must be the oppressor, and Palestinians must be the oppressed. Nuance gets flattened. History gets erased. The fact that Jews were refugees from European genocide, that they have indigenous ties to the land, that Arab states rejected partition in 1947, all of that complicates the binary, so it gets ignored.
The binary is a narrative, not an analysis.
Second, there's a deep ignorance of Jewish history. Most people on college campuses know about the Holocaust in broad strokes, but they don't know about the Dhimmi system, the Farhud, the expulsion from Arab countries, the centuries of persecution that preceded Zionism. So they see Israel as a European colonial project rather than what it actually was, a refugee movement of a persecuted people returning to their historical homeland.
Third, there's the social dynamics. In progressive spaces, anti-Zionism has become a marker of moral commitment. If you don't signal the right position on Israel, you're suspect. So people adopt the position without necessarily understanding what they're endorsing.
The social pressure is intense, and it creates a dynamic where criticism of anti-Zionism gets framed as silencing Palestinian voices or weaponizing anti-Semitism accusations. Which is a clever rhetorical move. It makes the anti-Semitism accusation itself the offense, rather than the behavior being accused.
The gotcha inversion. You're not an anti-Semite. I'm the real problem for noticing.
We've traced three distinct traditions. Christian anti-Semitism. Theological, rooted in deicide and supersessionism, eventually mutating into racial pseudoscience and culminating in the Holocaust. Islamic anti-Semitism. Legal and political, rooted in the Dhimmi system, relatively stable for centuries until the 20th century importation of European racial anti-Semitism produced mass expulsion. and anti-Zionist anti-Semitism, ideological, rooted in Soviet propaganda and post-colonial theory, hiding behind progressive language and the oppressor-oppressed binary.
Three different engines, three different mechanisms, three different sets of solutions required. What do we actually do with this analysis?
Let me offer three practical tests for identifying when criticism of Israel crosses into anti-Semitism. These aren't perfect, but they're a useful framework. First, does the statement deny Jews the right to self-determination that it grants to other peoples? If Palestinians have a right to national self-determination, and they do, then Jews have the same right. Anti-Zionism that denies this is not a political critique, it's a denial of Jewish equality.
Test 1. Is Jewish self-determination uniquely illegitimate?
Test 2. Does the statement apply standards to Israel that it does not apply to other nations? If you're organizing boycotts of Israeli universities but not Chinese universities, if you're condemning Israeli military operations but not Russian ones, if Israel's human rights record consumes your activism while Sudan's and Myanmar's and Iran's do not, you need to ask yourself why the Jewish state is uniquely worthy of your outrage.
Test 2, the singling out test. And test 3?
Test 3. Does the statement use classical anti-Semitic tropes? Conspiracy theories about Jewish or Zionist control, dual loyalty accusations, blood libel type allegations, and yes, accusing Israel of deliberately targeting children or harvesting organs is a modern blood libel. If your critique of Israel sounds like something a medieval inquisitor would recognize, you're not critiquing Israel, you're recycling anti-Semitism.
The three tests. Self-determination, double standards, classical tropes, that's useful.
The broader implication is that fighting anti-Semitism requires different strategies in different contexts. Christian anti-Semitism requires theological education, helping Christians understand that supersessionism is a misreading of their own scripture, that Judaism is a living covenant, not a rejected relic. Islamic anti-Semitism requires legal and political reform in Muslim-majority countries, plus education about the European origins of the protocols and other imported conspiracies. An anti-Zionist anti-Semitism requires ideological clarity, the willingness to say that denying Jewish self-determination while championing every other national liberation movement is not progressive, it's bigotry with better branding.
The most dangerous form of anti-Semitism is the one that goes unrecognized. Christian anti-Semitism was normalized for centuries. It was just the background radiation of European culture. Islamic anti-Semitism was embedded in law. It was the ordinary functioning of the state. And anti-Zionist anti-Semitism hides behind progressive language. It presents itself as anti-racism. Each form adapts to its environment.
As the memory of the Holocaust fades, the last survivors are now in their 90s. The historical guardrails weaken. People forget what anti-Semitism looks like because they've never seen it up close. They think it's always going to wear a swastika and carry a torch. But anti-Semitism is a shapeshifter. The history of anti-Semitism is a history of hatred, evolving to fit new contexts, new vocabularies, new justifications.
Understanding that evolution is the first step to recognizing it in its current form, whether it's wearing a cross, a crescent, or a kefir.
The question I keep coming back to is whether the current wave of anti-Zionist anti-Semitism is a permanent feature of the political landscape or something that will fade as the conflict evolves. I'm not optimistic. The ideological infrastructure is deep. It's embedded in universities, in NGOs, in international institutions. The Soviet propaganda framework has been fully absorbed by the progressive left. And the social dynamics that enforce anti-Zionist conformity are self-reinforcing.
The from the river to the sea generation isn't going to suddenly discover the history of the Dhimmi system or the Farhad. That's not how social movements work. You don't get disabused of a narrative that provides meaning and community just because someone points out factual errors.
Which is why this conversation matters. Not because we're going to change the minds of committed activists, but because there's a much larger group of people who are uncomfortable with what they're seeing, but don't have the historical framework to understand why. They sense that something is off, the singling out, the tropes, the intensity, but they can't articulate it. Giving people the vocabulary and the history is how you build resistance.
The three traditions, the three tests, the three strategies. Not a monolith. Never was a monolith. Anti-Semitism is a hatred that keeps reinventing itself, and the reinvention is the thing to watch.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1930s, Australian naturalist Hedley Finlayson documented octopuses in the Simpson Desert, not living specimens, but fossilized chromatophore sacs in ancient seabed deposits, suggesting that these color-changing organs could survive as identifiable structures for over 100 million years, long after the inland sea that once covered Central Australia had vanished. The chromatophores themselves, however, had not changed in fundamental design. The same cellular mechanism that let a Cretaceous octopus flash warning signals in a shallow Eromanga Sea is essentially identical to what a modern octopus uses today, making it one of the most conservatively preserved behavioral systems in the animal kingdom.
Right.
100-million-year-old color-changing mechanism preserved in desert fossils.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you found this episode valuable, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.